tell you a story here. There isn't really a research project involved in it, but there's a heck of an effort. And the effort is to get a lot of different disparate groups of people to work together toward a common goal. And if anybody has ever been involved with that, you'll know how hard a thing it is. The place that we are talking about here is the Southeastern Sandhills ecoregion. It's the region marked in black in the center of this map. Traditionally, this was considered to be dominated by longleaf pine, very open understory, a fire-supported community, extremely diverse herbaceous layer, as many as 200 different species in the ground layer, and for most of it, wiregrass is the dominant grass cover. As I said, extremely dependent on fire. Well, what's happening in this area? Well, a lot of the same things that are happening in places all over the country. A lot of the plant and animal species in this area are declining very seriously. Many of them have been listed or proposed for listing. The wet red-cockaded woodpecker is one of the obvious species that almost everybody has heard of. The gopher tortoise is listed in part of the region, proposed to be listed in the rest. The liatris there is an endangered species considered imperiled in the rest of the southeast. And these are just a few of a list as long as both arms that could be put together of things that are at risk. Now, the reason I bring up the woodpecker and the gopher tortoise is that they show some interesting sets of opportunities. Most of the conservation efforts have been directed at these two species, and they present an interesting set of challenges and opportunities, both one and the same. One person's challenge is another person's opportunity. The plant species, by and large, are not listed, are not federally listed. Their global status, if you take a look at the yellow column there, globally threes and fours, but if you look at their state status, they're twos or ones, which means so far as their presence in the state is concerned, they're critically short of numbers and habitat available to them. What's happened to plans and programs for trying to support these species? Well, the universal response to it is to dig them up and put them someplace. It's like taking the animals and preserving them all in a zoo. Well, you don't normally think of doing that for endangered animal species, but for some reason, when they're talking about endangered plant species, that's the kind of thing they want to do. They want to dig them up and take them and plant them in one place where they can hang on to them. Well, hanging on to them is a good idea, but the idea behind this whole effort here is that we might be able to have the one effort piggyback on the other. And the red-cockaded woodpecker management programs, Lord only knows, are well-funded. They're spending tens of millions of dollars a year to preserve and manage the physical habitat for the species. Even though the gopher tortoise is not listed in most of this area, they're also spending millions of dollars a year to manage that habitat. But the plant communities, the naturally occurring plant communities, are being lost without most people saying much about it. Well, there has been a CERDIP project, a DOD-funded research project, that is focused specifically on this, and my primary co-author here, Becky Sheretz from the Savannah River Ecology Laboratory, is the principal investigator. She studied populations of a suite of endangered or critically threatened plant species at three physical locations, at the Savannah River site itself in Aiken, South Carolina, at Fort Gordon near Augusta, Georgia, and at Fort Benning near Columbus, Georgia. And I know you can't read that chart down there. It's intentionally blurred. No, I'm kidding a little bit. For some reason, it didn't come out, and I couldn't figure out how to straighten it out. Essentially, they did a fairly rigorous sampling of places where these endangered or threatened plant species, the plant species at risk, resulted, where they actually were found. There's some people out in the field working on it. Established a grid, searched the grid in this area, characterized the soils, the existing vegetation, the overstory, and they found that all of these species were in fact associated with the type habitat that we are talking about, and they occur in these very xeric sandy soils. In fact, as Tim was saying, they are essentially infertile areas. There just is not much there to support their growth normally. Now, the question came about, well, now that we have found 150 places where these actually do grow, can't we use the information we've gathered about the sites where they do grow to project where they might grow? And in fact, you can. And using Fort Benning as an example here, they created a map of the places where the species occurred. They did a composite map, in this case is Fort Benning, showing where the potential habitat overlap is. And we make the note here, this could be useful to resource managers looking for places that that these might be maintained. And the answer is 58% of the gopher tortoise burrows, in this case using tortoise burrows, were within the areas identified as the habitat for multiple of these plant species at risk. Well, you know, this brings out a different question. Can't we get cooperation? And we did, in fact, generate a regional memorandum of agreement, this was signed by the Army and the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Air Force and the Departments of Natural Resources of all of the states involved, by NCASI, which is a private forest products organization, Department of Agriculture, you can see some of the names, and some non-government organizations as well, including the Conservation Fund and the Nature Conservancy. Well, if we look at this question, how can you get people to agree to do something? Well, I generated, I don't know that there are any really specific rules on it, but I generated these here. Some of them are obvious. It can't conflict with rules and laws that are already in existence. It has to have a general amount of public approval. It has to agree with the organization's way of doing business. Whatever commitment it is has to be affordable to the organization. And there's a very practical thing. It ought to be able to be something that makes the person signing it and agreeing to it look good to the rest of their organization. You know, if it makes them look bad, they aren't going to want to do it. Gee, that's kind of obvious. The memorandum of agreement is an agreement in principle. It doesn't really commit people to do a lot of specific expenditures of time and effort. And as I say here, that's probably why it was so easy to get people to join it. If we're going to want some specific effort, we have to take more specific action. And the candidate conservation agreement has been identified as the next target here. Well, what's a candidate species? Some of us have a kind of a general idea of what it is. This is the Fish and Wildlife Service's official definition of a candidate species. And they note that by working to recover the species before they are listed, in partnerships with the states and private and public landowners, it may well be possible to implement conservation methods that have better effect than if the species were just listed and tossed in a pile and nobody did anything about it in the future. candidate conservation agreement here, and agreements with assurances. The first is essentially limited to public agencies, the second to private landowners, and it serves to identify these purposes, identify willing landowners, willing partners, develop conservation methods, implement these conservation methods, and monitor their effectiveness. This is the same thing that you're asked to do if you are managing an endangered species. What's the difference? The difference is the species is not listed. There are no take issues involved. None of the restrictions that are inherent when you have a species that is in fact listed in law. An example is the Louisiana pine snake, involving national forests and Fort Polk. There is a candidate conservation agreement there. It precluded the listing of the species because it already agreed to do all of the things that people wanted to do if the species was listed. What's the benefit of it? These are some of the benefits here in terms of the military. The fact that it's compatible with the INRIP process, Integrated Natural Resources Management Program, and it avoids the negative consequences of listing on the land management objectives that you might have. Habitat is the key. We're preserving a habitat. We're not necessarily preserving individual species. If you think about it for a moment, is there such a thing as woodpecker habitat or gopher tortoise habitat or liatris habitat or even longleaf pine habitat? No, there is habitat. And if you preserve and manage the habitat for a single species, I don't care if it's the woodpecker or the tortoise or one of these plant species, by definition, you're managing it for all the species that can use that habitat. It's not just a twofer, it's a tenfer if you do the job right. And here's an example of a dozen or so species that can make use of that habitat if we preserve useful quantities of the habitat, regardless of whether they're on public or private property. And that's the end of my story. Thank you. Question or two? That's why I asked you that question. But because if you preserve the habitat, you're preserving it for everything that uses the habitat. You aren't talking about a single species.
And with this plan, that's actually part of the Air Force's goal, because they have gopher tortoise, they have several types of snakes that are involved.
Right.
In the biological opinion for this project, I think it was 36.
I was going to say, list as long as your arm of species.
Right. Directly impacted by this bombing range. So they're trying to do exactly that.
Right.
And that's actually how we picked our locations to put the new plants with the GIS map.
Right. Right. Any other questions? Alan?
So now with the CCA that you're working on,
right,
how do you really measure the effectiveness of the whole effort? You know, unlike other research where you have a control that you can compare back, have you been able to follow the funding or the decisions being made in those organizations so that you can look back and see what the
our next step is to have the management group, the CCA management group, set up a one-to-one meeting with the DNRs in each of the affected states to look at their processes that they are planning to put into place. We already have commitments from each of the services on how the services are going to enter into the governmental part of the agreement. And some of them are fairly general. Some of them simply reiterate the kinds of efforts that they're already doing, and everybody in the area that has these species is already working to try to maintain habitat for them to some degree at least.
So it isn't a case of starting from nothing. Some of them, several hundred thousand dollars a year directed toward the effort. Tony?
Now, is there any effort being made on the minimum size of the area you need to support all those species?
We have a research project that just finished in September that came back with some answers that suggested a minimum survival area of some 50 hectares and an ideal area of closer to 700. So it's a range, but at least it's a range. Okay, Tim?
Thank you, Allegan.